Big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast, and a theme that we are embracing for this series in 2021 is inclusive heritage. This will involve a broad overview of the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past, and will also put into context how this sense of heritage is all about our collective experience, and why so much of what went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. In this episode, to mark International Day of Women and Girls in Science, we're speaking with Hugh Tinney, whose mother Sheila was the first Irish woman to earn a PhD in mathematical science. Dr. Sheila Tinney was also among the first four women admitted to the Royal Irish Academy. We also talked to Dr. Eucharia Meehan, Chief Executive and Registrar of the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, DIAS. She charts the history and heritage of science in Ireland and its legacy for contemporary living. The story of Dr. Sheila Tinney, a pioneer in her chosen field, brings us back to segments of our heritage which have evolved unimaginably over the decades. I hope you enjoy the show. Hugh Tinney, how are you keeping?
Very well, Greg. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you as well. And a big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast.
Thank you.
Everyone's mother is special. But I believe your mother was extra special.
Yeah, we didn't really know that at the time, because I guess children just take a lot of things for granted. So I think my sister, for example, my sister Ethna has frequently said to me that she had no idea of, if you like, what mum had accomplished and how unusual it was until relatively recently. Well, we can speak a little bit more about it, but I think it was over time that we grew as kids to maybe appreciate that mum was a little bit different as a mother in some ways.
Sheila was the first woman in Ireland to earn a PhD in mathematical science. And there was a nice background story to that and where she came from and her mum and her dad. Like, you know, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. Could you fill me in that whole backstory and how maybe that came to being?
Yes, I guess the thing was that her father was himself a professor of mathematics in what is now NUIG and was then University College Galway. And he had six children, indeed. Mum was somewhere in the middle of all of those. They were nearly all girls. First of all, she had lost her mother, sadly, when she was only about eight. Her mum died, so he continued to bring up the five girls and one boy, as well as doing his teaching, mathematics teaching. So, you know, that can't have been too easy. But the eldest three daughters all went for medical degrees. And when mum came along, she had already developed a yen for mathematics, and she wanted to study mathematics. But her father, despite being a mathematician, wanted to put her off for reasons that we don't entirely know. I think he thought it was, you know, him perhaps himself having that career. I think he thought it was a difficult career and maybe not the most sociable career. Maybe it was, you know, he was trying to put himself in her shoes as, you know, as being a female mathematician. And given that there were probably, you know, very, very, very few female mathematicians, perhaps appeared as a forbidding future. So he was very keen that she would join the civil service. He wanted, you know, more or less insisted she would do the exams to enter the civil service. So she didn't refuse, but as stories would have it, she did it without enthusiasm. And eventually he gave way and she entered initially Galway University, but after a year she transferred up to Dublin. She transferred also from mathematics pure to mathematical science. So in Dublin, she was studying mathematical science.
I'm sure he was just being very practical, knowing it's probably not a role for a woman.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, who knows, maybe he was even thinking of the social aspect and, you know, maybe he was thinking of his own little grandchildren that she was going to have. I don't know. And that it would be kind of difficult. And in fairness to him, I know from what my mum told me that, you know, it was lonely, despite being quite high flying and despite all the colleagues and, you know, obviously male colleagues. But nonetheless, it was quite a lonely life, as she said. And later on, as she was in, you know, approaching and then entering her early 30s, she was starting to have doubts as to whether she was going to meet somebody that she could have a family with. You know, fortunately, that did happen. But I guess perhaps he wasn't altogether wrong in realizing that it mightn't be such an easy choice.
She had an obvious flair for mathematics, and obviously she grew up in those environments, as well as music being a big part of the family as well. I believe her mother was a very accomplished pianist.
Yes, obviously. Sadly, I never met her mum because she died when my own mother was still so young. But I saw the piano down there in, you know, the grandfather's house in Taylor's Hill in Galway. And it wasn't a great condition, but she had stories that when she would play, there was one of the dogs, much beloved dogs there, that would immediately start yowling and had to be put out of the room. Or perhaps it was the other way around. Perhaps he was yowling to come into the room. I'm not totally sure which, but that there was certain yowling that was going on. But she played quite intensely, I think. She played for even several hours a day, probably towards the end of her schooling, which was in Galway, for everything except her last year, I think, when she came to Dublin to Dominican convent in Cabra and for her final year. But up to then she was in Galway, so she could avail of the piano at home. And she, you know, I remember her fast forwarding. I remembered her when we were kids. She would encourage us because she would play a bit. She took up the piano a little bit again. She would play Chopin waltzes. She would play movements like the Moonlight Sonata movement, the Appassionata and of Beethoven. You know, a lot of things that were wonderful to hear. You know, wonderful to hear, because my father was very musical as well. He was a good singer and he was a reasonable pianist, although a kind of self-taught. But she had quite a bit of teaching and was well able to play. So I can still in my head hear her playing and see her playing some of those pieces.
So Hugh, I believe even at Leaving Cert stage, she was quite an exceptional student.
Yes, I think she was. She was one of those who did her Leaving through Irish, which entitled one to get an additional percentage. So I think she came out very high on the national scorecard, as it were.
Yeah, and just one of eight women in the country at that time who got an honour in Leaving Cert Maths. And putting that into perspective, there was 126 males. And that's in 1935 when so many people weren't even going on to doing Leaving Cert. So she was quite exceptional even at that early stage.
Yes, I think so. One thing I'd be very curious to know who her teacher was. You know, having discussing teachers, she herself becoming a teacher of mathematics and her father being a teacher of mathematics, I wonder who taught her mathematics in the Dominican convent in Taylor's Hill in Galway. But that I never heard.
Yeah, we won't even be able to find that in Google, I think.
No, I don't think so. If you had a bad maths teacher, it's quite hard to progress, you know. Certainly, I would have found it hard. I was very lucky in Dublin to have great maths teachers, but I'm not so sure. I also fell in love with mathematics, but I think the teacher was very important for that subject. But that's information that I don't actually know. But certainly, yes, she did progress to do the Leaving, in that.
Yeah, and she followed her career then into UCG and then onto UCD. And then I believe she went to Scotland on a scholarship.
Yes, she did. That was after she did a master's, I think, in Dublin, and then got a scholarship to do a doctorate degree in Edinburgh. And that was 1939. She was 21 when she was starting it. So she literally arrived just as the Second World War was starting and announced in September of 1939. Not, you might think, the best time to be travelling into the United Kingdom, you know. But she did, and there was a famous teacher there, Professor Max Born, very fine mathematician, physicist, and so he had a kind of a whole school of doctoral, very good doctoral students, which she joined. They were an international bunch, really, Indian, Chinese, talented young people, and so she spent 2 years on her doctorate there.
Yeah, and then back to UCD. As an assistant lecturer, and then in 1941, she became part of a dais.
Exactly so. Again, I think the timing was very good because she arrived back in 1941, but that was it was only a matter of months after the founding of dais. I think dais was founded in 1940, if I'm right, by Eamon de Valera. Because of his own interests, De Valera had set it up to have two schools originally, a school of Celtic studies and a school of theoretical physics. About 7 years later, a third school was added, which was a school of cosmic physics. So a curious place, you might say, because to have Celtic studies on the one hand and then two schools of physics and nothing else. So it was very particular, that Institute of Advanced Studies, but also very good. And the whole idea was that it was to be a really high-level centre of learning and a kind of a nexus to introduce Irish people to very strong mathematicians. And this very famous Erwin Schrödinger had arrived as the initial head of the theoretical physics department. So Mum's timing in that regard was brilliant, because, you know, she was literally coming back and invited to be a fellow, ironically, of DIAS, literally months after the great Erwin Schrödinger, who had arrived to take up his post there.
And your reference to De Valera, when I was doing my little bit of research, there's a lovely photograph. And I guess it was a modern day version of a PR photograph, where it was a whole row of people sitting down and your mother was at the far left, sitting at the far end of the bench, and De Valera was sitting bang smack in the middle. A little bit of history. Her career and family life, how did all that work you?
Well, I suppose the thing was that her most intense period in terms of producing papers and such like was definitely in her 20s. Now, I mean, they do say that that is one of the most fertile times, you know, that mathematicians, a lot of them do their prime work when they are young rather than when they're older. But she had the added fact that because she got married a little older than most for that period, because she would have been 33, I think, when she got married, 1952. And from that time on, really, her productive period in terms of producing papers and so on, mathematical papers, essentially stopped. In fact, the last paper that I'm aware of was after her one-year visit to Princeton Institute of Advanced Study, which actually was the model for De Valera's Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies. She spent a year there when she was 29, 30, and she was there basically, in a sense, garnering information for University College Dublin, finding out the latest information, mixing with the highest level people. Famously, you had Albert Einstein, who was living in Princeton at the time, but famous physicists like Richard Feynman, he wasn't living there, but he used to come up to Princeton. You had Freeman Dyson, and you had Robert Oppenheimer, who was actually the director of Princeton at the time. So somewhere we have a telegram signed by Oppenheimer welcoming my mother as a new arrival. But as far as I know, that her subject of study there was related to cosmic physics. And I find this interesting that there's a coincidence there that the School of Cosmic Physics in Dublin was added to DIAS in 1947. And at the same time, my mum in 1948 to 49 was writing a paper about so-called tau or tau mesons, which were particles which were arriving in cosmic rays. So that must have been that cannot be an accident. It must have been a period where cosmic ray physics was suddenly the thing, and is related to obviously elementary particle physics and indeed quantum theory. Quantum theory became Mum's primary focus, if you like, both through her doctorate but also through her teaching years. So very much quantum field theory and also elementary particle physics.
Quite a different mother to the mother most of us would experience, I'm guessing.
I suspect so, yeah.
So was it maths all the way with you and your other siblings?
No, I would say not at all. We got a lot of influences, really, because my mom and dad both liked sports. I mean, my dad would happily watch any football of any description, on a Sunday or Saturday afternoon, Gaelic, football, rugby. We all played tennis when we were young. My mum had played tennis as well when she was in Princeton, I think. She used to love skiing in her 20s, That's something I never got up to. But there was that. Then there was the music that we've talked about, and that was very much there in the family as well. And then there was a reasonable width of interest. I mean, there were interest, both parents were interested very much in the humanities as well, in languages. And my father was, as I said, principally a singer. So he would have sung in French songs and German songs, Lieder, and even some light opera. So it was far from being all mathematics. But on the other hand, you know, mum was always available to help out if any of us three children, myself and my two sisters, if we were struggling with something that we were doing at school, she would often help out. We used to laugh between ourselves that sometimes her explanations went a little bit further than her children were at the time capable of comprehending. And so sometimes we left slightly none the wiser, if you like, than when we arrived, but we had learned some new concepts along the way, you know.
In the last few years, with her centenary, she's been recognized by a lot of different institutions, in particular because she was a female who stood out. And you know, the whole world now was looking at females and having roles in STEM and everything else. How would she have felt about that, do you think?
I think she would have been very happy actually to think about it because she was by no means a feminist in some ways, but on the other hand, she was very supportive of other women who were studying. She had very good friends in university college, you know, members who were maybe non-scientists, linguists. I remember one of her best friends was a lady called Maribel Foley, who was a Spanish lady. And, you know, there was a wide mixing. And incidentally, also, Mum enjoyed very much, you know, having sort of house parties at home. So we would get an influx, if you like, of mathematicians, primarily mathematicians, but also some musicians, people like Professor Anthony Hughes, the professor of music in New University College Dublin, but also a great mix of people. It was, you know, Trinity College people who were there as well. It wasn't just the UCD people. So, you know, I think she was quite Catholic in that sense of the word. To her, if you were an interesting person, it didn't matter if you were male or female, it didn't matter if you were from Trinity or from UCD or from Galway or from Dublin or, you know, it was very kind of open in that way. But I think she would have been very happy to think about the recognition later on. She never sought recognition, but I think it would have pleased her and maybe even surprised her a little bit.
Did you get any sense at all from her, Hugh, that she may have felt at a disadvantage to her male colleagues?
I think, yes, I did. I feel that, you know, obviously she was teaching in UCD for a very long time. I mean, very long time, 37 years from the age of 23 up to when she retired, decided to retire early when she was 60. So it was a long time. And she moved from being an assistant lecturer there to being an associate professor. But she also had to carry a large load, as it happened, because of circumstances in that department. It was a department of mathematical physics that she was associate professor of. Circumstances led to her actually having to carry a large load, and you know, some people would have perhaps felt that she should have been made head of department. I don't know what her views would have been about that. She never expressed a view on that subject, but I think there were certain things, and she was aware of what you would call perhaps the old boys network at the top level within UCD, the people who in the very top jobs, you know, administratively of you know, you would find that they were good pals of each other and that kind of thing. She did refer to that a bit, not in a nasty way, but she clearly saw it and she wasn't afraid to comment on it. And so I think in her quiet way, she was getting across that the imbalance, if you like, of influence. And she never protested. She would come home with stories that were interesting stories. And one of the political things going on at the time was the possibility, there was talk of a merger between UCD and TCD in the 1960s. So we used to hear quite a lot about the merger, which of course never happened in the end of everything. So we gleaned pieces of information like that. And later on, I mean, I became interested in elementary particle physics and astronomy and where these link together in astrophysics. And that was a great point of contact with my mother. In fact, she was able to give me, if you like, my first books on elementary particle theory about the electrons, the protons and neutrons, and then the more advanced things that were coming on, you know, into the picture. So That was a very nice point of contact between her and me, and we used to spend long afternoon teas discussing those kind of things. And she would reminisce about, for example, her time in Princeton and famous mathematicians like Paul Dirac or Wolfgang Pauli, you know, all of whom kind of came across her path, or she came across their paths. And, you know, I wish I could remember a lot more of it than I actually do remember, because memory is so imperfect. But at the same time, we were, you know, I certainly was, but I think all three of us were, you know, we were at that stage when we were in our teens, we were aware that this, you know, this was not average home conversation over the afternoon tea table, you know. So it was great. It was great.
Yeah, and outside of the maybe the politics of big organizations and hierarchies and everything, from what you're saying, I get a sense that her mathematical peers just saw another mathematician.
Yes. I think they did. And, you know, again, they were such a rarity in that period, even the 1960s. You know, if I think of the people who were assembled in my parents' house at the parties I mentioned, I'm struggling to think of a female mathematician at all, unfortunately. Whereas there were, you know, as I say, there were Trinity people, there were UCD people, and sometimes visiting professors from India or wherever. But a female mathematician, really, really no. Not in the 1960s. I wasn't seeing any. Not here in Ireland. There were some, of course. There was some, she knew somebody who became quite famous, a lady called Cécile Moret, or Cécile de Witt Moret, became a very distinguished mathematician, and they were together in Princeton and so on. So, I mean, there were mathematicians, and you know the photographs you mentioned, actually, which some of which have De Valera surrounded by these rows and rows of people attending a conference, and you would see, you know, a fair number of women dotted around in amongst the physicists and scientists there, and some of them were from Ireland, but not specifically from UCD. I think they were maybe from Belfast or around the place, and of course there would be international visitors as well. So I guess that was the situation at the time.
And her role in guiding you and your two sisters in terms of their education, would she have been different between the three of you, or did you have a very clear idea as to the path all of you were going to take, or was that totally up to yourselves?
I think if I may use a mathematical or arithmetical term, I'd say it was probably 95%. Up to us, or maybe more than 95%. I'm just quickly now flashing back to my two sisters, both of whom, well, Deirdre went to do modern languages in Trinity. Ethna was a little bit torn because she was interested in languages and the arts, but she was also a very, very good pianist, and she, you know, I think was struggling a little bit between which direction to go. Whereas I was not yet thinking of myself as a musician. So I was very clear I wanted to do mathematics in university. And in the end of the day, ironically, all three of us went to Trinity, which was kind of strange given that Mum was professor in UCD, but that's the way it happened. But no, I think both our parents were terrific in that they were really supportive, absolutely wanted the best for us. Didn't try to over-influence us in terms of the course of what direction we would go in, and did support us as much as they could, you know.
And retiring, did that come easy to her?
I think the retirement itself did come easy to her. I think she was starting to find it hard going when she was approaching 60. You know, she said as much that, you know, she was finding it harder than she had. And I think the early years of her retirement, she enjoyed the freedom, and she started doing things like going to art appreciation classes in the National Gallery with one of her longtime best friends, and also started playing a lot more golf, playing in golfing teams, stuff like flower arranging, you know, and just spreading her wings a bit and seeing friends and so forth, and attending a lot of concerts also. And I guess the fact that her offspring were starting to actually be on the stage and playing concerts was an enormous interest for her and for my father. So they would come to lots of concerts, and they would go to lots of concerts that we weren't in. So she was a regular attender of the RTE Symphony Orchestra concerts, and later when it became the National Symphony Orchestra as well, you know. So she had plenty of things to do and plenty of things that she enjoyed doing.
What was her biggest achievement, the thing that she was proudest of herself?
That's a very good question because that's not something I've thought of before. And I don't remember her saying, this is my proudest achievement, or that. She never expressed that in words. For all those hours of conversations that I had with my mother over our afternoon tea, that's not something I remember her saying. I think she was, in her way, very proud of her work and very dedicated to and involved. She was proud of her students. She had some great students. One who became celebrated, Lachlan O'Rafferty, became himself the head of one of the departments in Dias in due course. But she had other terrific students, and she would talk about the students, and they might be master's level students or, or a doctorate. So she was very interested, and she loved talented students, mathematical students, and really, wanted to see them do very, very well. But as I already said, she had a fantastic interest in us three children and was hugely supportive. So I think all these things, all these things were very important to her. That's my feeling.
There was a sad end to her life then, and I know Alzheimer's, that cruel disease, she fell prey to it, the same as so many other people.
She did indeed, and it was only kind of really being called Alzheimer's for the first time around then, because when I was younger, Alzheimer's used to be specifically used for pre-senile dementia. Nowadays, it's used far more broadly for that. It's used for a particular form of dementia that can affect, and mainly affects the elderly, but can affect young people as well. And so it's used in a much, much broader way. So I guess they gradually found out more and more about it. I would have known about elderly people sometimes suffering from dementia. I wouldn't have had a name to put to it. And I guess I would never have imagined my mum falling prey to that because she was so bright and so, lively and interested in things and all of that. So it was a strange thing. And I remember as we gradually became aware of it, us three of us having a private discussion and what did we think about this? And, I was kind of thinking, oh no, she's just aging a bit and it's just her memory, she can't remember as many things. So I was, if you like, slow to take on board what eventually became clear. And that was the route she was going, At least the good news is that it was a slow progression in her case and mainly started to intervene in her life from her 70s onwards. And I would say from 70 to 75, that was, if you like, the time when it was starting to become more visible.
To witness a loved one with such a sharp mind, that must have been awful for you to witness. Was it frustrating for her as well, was it?
Oh, I think it was hugely frustrating for her. I think it was. So it was a mixture of frustration and anxiety. She knew what was happening, but then she wouldn't necessarily remember because of the nature of the disease. So therefore, there was never a moving on in a sense. It was just a constant frustration and maybe asking the same question, kind of what's happening, what's going on. She was very good at holding her own and she would come to concerts and maybe, my father was very good to her and would bring her around and she would socialize and she would meet people. And many of those people wouldn't have even known that she had Alzheimer's. So, despite the condition.
So she passed in 2010, and she's obviously left a fantastic legacy, and that's been celebrated and acknowledged now. But for you, Hugh, what's your fondest memory of her?
Gosh, I mean, there's so many. I think I mentioned one, which was her influence when we were very young, listening to her playing the piano and these Chopin waltzes, which still, when I hear them, they have a particular emotional association. I think music that you hear very young does tend to affect you slightly differently from music that you learn, let's say, in your teens or your 20s or afterwards. And I mean all types of music. I'm not just talking about classical music. I think, She Loves You, which I would have heard when I was about 5 or 6. That also brings back, those very early memories or even the Monkees, So, but hearing your own mother playing on an upright piano, particular waltzes of Chopin, it did leave a very deep imprint. But I just have so many good memories of her, so many lovely memories of her and in the home, coming with us to for tennis matches and the tournaments, or I remember her coming to London with my father to see concerts that I was involved in, and then they came to Madrid in 1986. and they came to London in 1993. And by 1993, she was approaching her mid-70s and things were getting difficult at that stage. You know, so it is wonderful to think that she got the most, and thanks to my father also, she got the most out of even, you know, her retirement period before Alzheimer's took its toll.
Yeah. Well, Hugh, thank you so much for sharing the story of a very special woman, your mother. And a big thank you to everyone from the Heritage Council.
Delighted to share these memories with you, Greg, and with the Heritage Council.
I hope you enjoyed the first segment of our show with Hugh Tinney, the son of Dr. Sheila Tinney. In the second segment, I chat with Dr. Eukarya Meehan, Chief Executive and Registrar of the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, about the impact that Sheila had on her profession and the legacy that she has left behind. Dr. Eukarya Meehan, how are you keeping?
I'm keeping well, thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you for joining the Heritage Council podcast to talk about Dr. Sheila Tinney. And we've heard already from her son, Hugh, and he filled us in about her life and her career and his mother, you know, which is really lovely. That was a lovely story to hear. And you're the CEO and the registrar of DIAS, the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies. So before we talk about Dr. Sheila Tinney, could you tell me a little bit about you and your role?
Okay. Well, the Institute for Advanced Studies is an independent research and advanced studies institute that was established back in the 1940s. So we're actually celebrating our 80th birthday between June of 2020 and June of 2021. And I suppose within the structure of the institute, even though I'm a scientist myself, by background, I have an administrative role. And I see my role, I suppose, as supporting the very talented researchers and academics at DIAS to do their work by ensuring that they have facilities and all a whole range of supports to do their work. And I also have a role then, obviously, in helping promote their work and ensuring they can continue to do the great work that they do, whether it's in geophysics, astronomy and astrophysics, maths, whatever area, Celtic studies, whatever area it is.
And while we're celebrating International Day of Women and Girls in Science, we could be having a conversation about you as much as we could be about Sheila Tinney, but obviously we're in a different era and a different time. Are there parallels?
Well, there would be some parallels in, well, first of all, I'm a Galway graduate. So we have NUIG as a common grounding in terms of she would have begun some of her academic work there, her academic career there before she moved to UCD. And I suppose in terms of the challenges of actually, I think in terms of the challenges of dealing with career and then marriage, family and those kinds of things, we probably would have a lot in common because it does impact on how your life actually evolves. When I would have worked as a scientist first in the private sector and then more in the public sector, you do become aware of what they call the glass ceiling, which fortunately I think isn't as strong a ceiling as it used to be. But I would have become aware of it. And I think it would have been something that perhaps Sheila would have become aware of ultimately too, in terms of her own career progression when she was in UCD, because she was a brilliant scientist and was an associate professor, but never went to the full extent up the ladder in the academic world.
Yeah. And chatting to Hugh about her, he was more or less saying that to her peers, there was no difference. You know, all the mathematicians and the scientists just viewed each other as equal. But maybe the hierarchies and organizations may have viewed things a little bit different.
I think that's a very good point because, I mean, Erwin Schrödinger, she was one of his first three fellows that he recruited when he came to DIAS to work with him, which in itself is a very significant achievement because there was quite a number of people who applied to actually work with him. And the fact that he described her as among the best equipped and most successful of the younger generation of theoretical physicists of the time is, you know, it's I think one of the standout commendations of her. And then subsequently, of course, she was one of the first four women to become a member of the Royal Irish Academy. So in other fora, you know, she, and with her peers, as you say, she was very much recognized for an absolute outstanding talent.
They're not saying gender, they're just saying a brilliant mind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, one of her contemporaries at Dais would have been a lady called Cécile de Vitte, who went on to become one of the best known theoretical physicists in France, for example. So she really worked with the best, the fact that she was invited out to the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton for a period of time. So all of these things demonstrate her absolute fabulous capacity in theoretical physics and mathematics.
And back to 1935, when she was doing her Leaving Cert, she was one of 8 women in the country who did honours maths. And there was 126 men. Now, the numbers are really, really low when you think about it. And obviously, that's where third level education and second level education and everything, where those things were sitting at the time. Those types of ratios, if I look at your case, were you the only girl in the room for a lot of the courses that you took and a lot of the choices that you made?
I actually was more on the biology side. So in fact, my background is biochemistry and then my PhD is in pharmacology. So traditionally, those more biology orientated sciences do tend to have a higher proportion of women. So women would not have been, it wouldn't have been 50-50, but it certainly would have been maybe 30-40% women in the classes I would have been in. But if you look across at other areas, or, you know, I would have had, you know, friends in the physics domain, they would have been in a situation where there would have been a handful of them, or indeed in engineering, a handful of them that were female within those class cohorts. And so it does very much depend on the discipline and the area. And one of the things that's interesting about Sheila is that she actually was one of the first to break through, if you like, into a domain, theoretical physics, that was seen very much as being a male domain, you know, being the first to get a PhD in theoretical physics / mathematics in the UK. And I suppose that reflects, if you like, kind of a standout point historically for the history of science, if you like, because traditionally, women would have been, as they are now, more prevalent in some of those more biological science areas. And it would have been those areas that they would have, almost from an amateur perspective, followed, because couldn't get into university. For example, you couldn't get into university as a female in Ireland until the 1880s. And then you had the issue that for a lot of disciplines and areas, it wasn't acceptable. There were social norms for women to go into certain areas. An example would be Aileen Cust, who had great difficulty in getting a qualification to be a veterinarian, actually recognised. So Sheila then represents, if you like, a further trajectory into the world of physics and mathematics, which actually to this day is still very male dominated and really breaking through there. So she's very important, both in terms of what she did herself, but also in the history of science more generally.
Why is it so male dominated, do you think?
I think it's very hard to, you know, what is it they always say in business, that culture trumps strategy? I think it's very hard to break down and to change cultures. And it's all got to do with conditioning. I mean, I would know myself, actually, going back to your earlier question, that the secondary school I went to in Donegal initially, well, initially there was no honours maths. And then when they had honours maths, it was mainly the boys who did honours maths, even though it was a predominantly girls' school. There's just a lot of social conditioning around these things, which is very hard to break down. And I suppose over time, there just is built in to everyone a level of unconscious bias against certain areas, whether it's parents or guidance teachers or whoever. So, and I think then these things become self-fulfilling when, if there aren't role models there that actually women can look to, for example, in particular areas of physics, they're just less likely then to enter those areas. So there is a lot of work, and we're doing work ourselves at Dais to try and increase, if you like, the attractiveness of the discipline and to show that there are women in the physics areas and to kind of break down some of those perception barriers at this stage. So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to change centuries, actually, really, of culture and societal expectation.
And we need our role models.
And we need our role models. And that's why Sheila is very important, because she is sadly we lost her in 2010, but she is still a contemporary role model. And that's one of the reasons when I'm only at Dais in the role I'm in for 3 years, that one of the first things I did, because Dais itself would have been perceived as being a very male organization, even though if you look at the composition, actually, it's actually about 40%, 60% male, female, was actually moved to recognize and give recognition to some of the women scientists who had come through the doors historically, and to make their contribution in science known. And thus we commissioned the portrait of Sheila, which hangs proudly in our boardroom today.
And her relationship with Dais, and she was the first ever female fellow of Dais at the time. That was a groundbreaking episode or event.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about it is when you actually look back through the papers and the material that is there, it wasn't actually within Dais seen as being that big of a deal, actually, because Schrodinger picked the best. And in effect, there was three people picked. One of the others I've mentioned already, a woman, Cécile de Vitte, went on to become one of the best known theoretical physicists ever in France. And then there was a gentleman, Peng, from China, who, when he went back, headed up their nuclear program and became, is today, if you mention Peng in China, everyone knows who Peng is. So I think Dais was a very unique type of entity in that you had Schrodinger and other international intellectuals coming to Dais. They just seemed to have a different perspective. The gender thing definitely wasn't as dominant at that time. And Sheila was accepted. Although, having said that, when you actually look at photographs of who came to colloquia and meetings they organized at the time, women were in the minority. But again, she was in very good company, because I'm always very struck by the fact that there are a number of photographs of her in the company of a woman called Kathleen Lonsdale, who actually is another really famous international scientist, who was born Yardley in Newbridge and actually went on to, she then went to the UK in her teens. She discovered that the benzene ring was flat and is very famous for actually doing work in X-ray crystallography. And there's photographs of Sheila with Kathleen Lonsdale, who actually came over. So I think there probably was a consciousness that she was in the minority, but actually I don't think it was kind of really, in terms of them doing their work and their research, I don't think it really was a factor.
Yeah, she was a peer. She was another brilliant mind, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you think back, that was the early 40s. Dais existed in a particular bubble at that point within the Irish context. It was a very, very unique entity. I mean, obviously over time from that point forward, I think the organization maybe became more influenced by societal norms and conventions, potentially, although no one has actually studied this or looked at that, but it was bound to have been affected in that way, as were other institutions.
In her particular circumstances, we can use the word outlier, but her father was a professor in UCG in mathematics. Her mum was a pianist, you know, so she took on board all of that. And it was probably the most natural thing in the world for her to become a mathematician, just follow the things that she was interested in. There were no barriers. And maybe since then, I guess in a way that society has to organize in particular ways, which unfortunately sends people down probable routes. So the outliers don't happen anymore. And I guess in a way, we haven't seen enough female outliers in the scientific area as a result.
Her family background was obviously very important. When you look kind of through from the late 1700s, the people that would have preceded her in the history of science, females in the Irish context, you know, there are others. Family background is incredibly important, and particularly the support of fathers and brothers in terms of females being encouraged to engage in science. So I think that's important. The other point I would make is that actually probably now is still somewhat important, but I actually think a change for the good is that that's probably less important now. So I mean, I think even when I would have been going to college, you would have expected, you know, it would have been the sons of lawyers, the sons of doctors who were doing law and, you know, going into medicine. But I actually think that has changed now. That still is there, but I think now there is more openness to people who want to get into whatever area it is. There is a lot more freedom for people to move into those areas. But unfortunately for females, there probably are still a number of areas that, if you like, are almost bastions that still really, in terms of actually getting that flow through, that still needs to happen. But I think a lot of progress has been made, to be fair. So
does she help you in your work, having that reference point all of the time, this female example, this female role model? Does that help you to tell your story within DIAS?
I think it does. I think it absolutely does. She was first. She is probably, I mean, there are a couple that came after her that are very well known as well, but certainly she stands out in terms of both the own work. The fact that, I mean, she was just such a talented individual, such a polymath. And then the fact that she, to be honest, one of the things I really like about her and her story is the fact that she was very supportive of other younger researchers. This is often remarked about her. So whilst she actually was at UCD and was a lecturer at UCD, I'm sure Hugh mentioned this, she actually spent what time she could then at DIAS doing work. So even after she had a number of years as a formal fellow, there then was a period of time she was what's called an associate, so that she would try and spend time at the Institute doing work on top of, if you like, her commitments at UCD. So she managed to balance an awful lot of things, an awful lot of interests. So I find that quite inspiring. And the fact that within UCD, I think she was very encouraging and a dais of women coming through in theoretical physics and mathematics areas. So she's very much a role model, you know, on a number of levels, I think, for me and for others.
I was asking Hugh if he thought she would have liked the attention that she got, obviously, at her centenary, and the portrait being commissioned and being hung in the boardroom. And he thinks she absolutely would have liked that. What do you think?
I suppose from talking to Hugh and his siblings, it sounds to me like she'd be the kind of woman that would be perhaps silently pleased. And why not? And why not? I think, you know, in terms of her work, both as a researcher, but as also as an educationalist, I think, you know, she has a lot to be, you know, a lot to be pleased about. And why wouldn't she?
In a way, Eukarya, you're describing someone who is passionate about what they do, about their profession, and they've devoted all of their time to it, and they love sharing that passion with their peers and younger students coming through, no different to anyone else. And in her case, she happened to be a woman and not a man. And it doesn't matter. Her peers just recognized her for who she was and what she did and what she believed in. What's her legacy?
I think her legacy, I think there's a couple of dimensions to that. I think the fact that she broke through, I suppose, became well known in the area of theoretical physics at a particular point in time, she will always have a legacy as a role model for others. And I think, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, actually just being the first to be awarded a doctorate in mathematics isn't, you know, sometimes that doesn't really signify. But the fact that then she went on and actually, you know, was acknowledged by one of the leading scientists, I suppose, at the time, and indeed ever probably, shows that actually being first and then being given opportunities, that an awful lot can be, women can achieve an awful lot. And all of the endorsement that she got through her career, particularly the early part of her career in the research domain, shows that when opportunities are presented and there are mentors there, whether they're male or female, that actually, you know, potential really can be fulfilled. So I think in spite of conventions that, you know, these things can be overcome if the right supports are there. And I think the third area where she really is where she has a legacy is the fact that she then herself actually would have supported others and endeavoured to support others in the same way. So very much within UCD, within when she would have come to dais to colloquia and then spent time at dais, she would have then encouraged others to actually, I suppose, pursue their dream and to do what they wanted to do, and particularly to support females. She did some interesting scientific work at the time around stability of crystals. She did some interesting work in quantum thermodynamics and particle physics. She actually had a range of scientific interests, and she made her contribution there. But I think her legacy really is in terms of just herself as what she achieved, her role model, both being a role model in terms of that, and then in her assisting others.
Yeah, so she broke the mold. She encouraged others. She passed the baton for others to pass the baton onwards and onwards. And here we are in 2021. So Dr. Eukarya Meehan, yeah, CEO and Register of DIAS, thank you so much for joining the Heritage Council podcast today and sharing your story and telling us all about a very famous Irish woman, Dr. Sheila Tinney. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.